Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 77, at the very beginning, which is old single column page 855. Okay, as I was mentioning at the very end of the preceding session, we have this, to a degree, off to the side paper here, before we pick up with the immediate consequences of Adam and Eve and their progeny going forward. They need to drop back, bring the Noddite line forward for us up to Adam and Eve's time, and in the process point out the immortal inhabitants that are part of the first two dispensational sons that showed up. The primary and the secondary midwares. We've touched upon them, in several spots in papers past. But here they give you a lot more about secondary midwares relative to this world, rather than just the nature of primary and secondary midwares in general, regardless of what world they're on. So the specifics and the unique things that are in play on this world, that gave rise to them. So we'll touch a little bit on those issues of in what ways it's different on this world than the norm when we actually start reading about them. And if we need to, we can hearken back and look at a couple of things they've said in the past that they're basically expecting you to have in mind as you're reading. I don't think we need to say anything else up front. Let's just jump in and see what we've got.
Paper 77, The Midway Creatures. Most of the inhabited worlds of Nevadon harbor one or more groups of unique beings existing on a life-functioning level about midway between those of the mortals of the realms and of the angelic orders. Hence are they called midway creatures. They appear to be an accident of time, but they occur so widespreadly and are so valuable as helpers that we have all long since accepted them as one of the essential orders of our combined planetary ministry.
Okay, so let's just notice a couple little things that they're highlighting up front. The very first thing they bring out might throw you for a little loop. So it says, most of the inhabited worlds of Nevadon harbor one or more groups. First of all, it's like most of. They told us way back when we talked about midwares that it's not a given that a world has midway creatures. We all know there's lots of variability in the universe of universes, so that's an additional optional element that maybe a world doesn't have, and they don't get into a lot of specifics. You can even imagine it's like, well, maybe they have primaries but not secondaries, or maybe they have secondaries but not primaries, or maybe they have neither, etc. But nonetheless, even a little exception that we represented for 500,000 years, we were an inhabited world. We had will creatures, before the prince's staff arrived, so that you could have had primary midwares. So there's even a little case where you could have an inhabited world, because normally the prince arrives not too long after the first will creatures, you know, so. But then the other little thing there, one or more? I thought there were primary and secondary midway. Shouldn't it say one or two? The deal there is that the primaries are a relatively straightforward phenomenon. But the secondaries can come into existence in many different ways. And what they're hinting at between the lines is, on some worlds, maybe you actually have two flavors of secondary midwares coming into existence at different times in different ways. The more than one would be multiple flavors of secondaries that they're suggesting there. I'm trying to think if you go back and look there, didn't they? I think it's, wasn't it, I'm trying to think, something like 24, wasn't it? Let's see here, where did they say that? I can't find it right off the bat. Where was it? Probably right here. There are no less than 24 diverse techniques involved in the production of these secondary midway creatures on the evolutionary worlds of space. I'm hearkening back to paper 38, section 9, where they had a whole section there on the midway creatures also. So see that fact that there can be so many different 24 diverse techniques. So I mean, obviously they haven't even remotely given us the details where we could speculate about what all those different modes would be. Obviously a lot of stuff involving beings that are that close to us in nature that they wouldn't be allowed to talk about because of the revelatory limitations. But nonetheless, that's what that deal is about. The
curious wording. Yeah. Say no less. That might mean the numbers.
Yeah. Right. Right. I mean, obviously they say that because there's a lot of the finite, yet to go. Who knows what might crop up unexpectedly on a, not yet even, constructed world in a not even yet constructed local universe, right? You could especially imagine that they would speculate about things when the closer the grand universe gets to being settled in light and life. They all would humbly point out that there could be all kinds of things that could happen that no one could even remotely imagine, as a possibility. So, remember they make a comment about that, in terms of, how unexpected it was that when Magistan came into existence. No one would even think of claiming that they know what things the supreme being might have in store, in that top-down engagement of the finite as the finite gets closer and closer. From the time viewpoint, as the finite gets closer and closer to completion, but from the eternity viewpoint, there already is a supreme being, and not only created Magistan, but he's got all his deputies running about, the unqualified supervisors of the supreme, and right, there's all of that transcendent stuff going on. So, and the reason that is even that's very relevant specifically to talking about midway creatures is what's between the lines when they say they appear to be an accident of time, et cetera there. You've heard me mention so often when they come up, the midwayers, instead of being a phenomenon that everyone, you know, all the celestials can directly understand, as you have the existential beings on the Isle of Paradise and you have a whole order of ministry that reaches down, you know, deeper and deeper into the experiential, stemming down from the Isle of Paradise. All of that is very, you know, overt and understood. But midwayers are, you know, examples of beings, you know, there's probably lots of them, but they didn't reveal them to us, but a type of being that coalesces, you know, you could say coalesces out of the mother rather than being a downstepped expression of a father-like ministry. I mean, even in the case of angels, you know, that you think of as being daughters, you know, of, say, a local universe mother, you know, still it's all stemming down from, you know, an existential third person, you know, and et cetera. So you have these beings that it's all very mysterious. No one understands the physics of it all. You know, no one can, they just come into existence, you know. The little literal construct of them is very mysterious, and exactly when and where and, you know, why and whatnot, you know, that they come into existence, you know, that hasn't been precisely planned in general, and it's just so it all is in the wholeness of the Supreme that these phenomena coalesce and come into existence. All right, so you've got that, and then and then that last little bit about long since accepted them. That's why we've heard about them before. You know, like back there in that paper, that's the ministering spirits of the local universe paper. I mean, they're talking about the ministering spirits, and they throw in the midway creatures, like they're saying there, because they're part of the ministry. Everyone just goes, well, I don't know why you're here or you know, what's going on, but, you know, you look useful, let's put you to work, all right? And so, and we'll, you know, we'll see that, you know, the very curious ones, you know, as you kind of saw when I went back there and read, are the secondary midwares. Those are the ones that obviously start to seem very much like a quote-unquote accident of time, you know, coincidentally, you know, and no one expected, you know, like, you know, our planet is a great example of that. Out come secondary midwares. You know, so they, you know, they very much, you know, are just sort of adopted ad hoc into whatever's going on the planet. It's like, well, we can use you for this right now. Let's let you wear this hat. And, you know, the primaries are more straightforward. They're, you know, everyone is basically expecting them unless the life carriers have designed the world to not have them. All right, then one little tidbit they give in the preface there.
On Urantia, there function two distinct orders of midwayers, the primary or senior core, who came into being back in the days of Dalmatia, and the secondary or younger group, whose origin dates from the times of Adam.
Yeah, okay, so the basic issue, and you'll notice that you can kind of see the explanation I gave you for the one or more there, the way they say two distinct orders, right? I mean, the primary and secondary are distinctly different. Obviously, if you had different flavors of secondaries, they wouldn't be as distinctly different. You know, that's the reason why they're, you know, they would throw in that distinct word. I mean, it's seemingly, you know, is not adding anything until you recognize, what the deal is with the more up there. All right. Now, and that's and they're repeating what they told you before. I mean, it's always the case that the primaries are tied to the prince's staff, and the secondaries are tied in some way to Adam and Eve, you know, or the progeny. Okay. As they're about to tell us, it's like, well, we've got a curious thing where, you know, there's a little linkage actually, that sort of indirectly connects the primaries and the secondaries on this planet. Man, that's not normal, threaded through the Noddites. But that's another reason why they're stating that. They just want to remind you, of that. And, it sounds here like, oh, well, maybe on other worlds, it's always that the secondaries are tied to the Adamic and the primaries to the prince's staff. So that's all quote unquote normal, that element of it. All right, so they're going to give us a little about the primaries here again. So think back to the prince's staff now.
Number one, the primary midwares. The primary midwares have their genesis in a unique interassociation of the material and the spiritual on Urantia. We know of the existence of similar creatures on other worlds and in other systems, but they originated by dissimilar techniques.
Okay, so even in that tiny little first paragraph, you should be feeling a tension of lack of explanation of some details. This is why I brought it up just recently, I remember. There's a whole spiritual economy, it's a term they use here shortly. There's this spiritual energy system and stuff, to a world, and it changes distinctly from dispensation to dispensation. All the physics of that is completely unrevealed and mysterious. Okay, and so they're hinting at a twofold thing. On the one hand, you can understand part of the material, quote unquote, unique interassociation in the material side. You've got Andonites. All right, the prince's staff genetically are based on the Andonites. I mean, most worlds don't have a pre-colored race. Okay, so that obviously is making it different. But you're also getting the sense that the whole spirit energy system on the planet is different than normal because the matter, the material biology is different than normal. In some quite distinct way, a unique interassociation. Okay, you can, you end up with things like they're saying, kind of similar, but it's hinting at all that mystery that we so often talk about, and on top of it, reminding, and we'll see this very definitively as we go forward, there is so much more to our world than meets the eye. I mean, it seems to you day in, day out, that you're just playing around with matter. You're bending your material body over and you're picking up this material cup and then you're bending over and putting it back down again, and you're standing up and you're walking, right, and breathing air and, we're exercising your thumb muscles, with your handheld device or whatever, right? But remember, the energy is a triunity. Matter, mind, and spirit are a triune system of energy. Right? They aren't really as separated as they appear, or even as it would seem when they tell you about the origin of matter, mind, and spirit and how it's rooted in absolutes of matter, mind, and spirit. It's like, well, they're absolutely separate then. Right? If there's an absolute of matter and an absolute of mind and an absolute of spirit, yes, but there's a super absolute mother deity presence that coordinates the three together, inescapably coordinates them together. So no matter how much it appears that all is involved and I'm moving this cup around is just molecules, that's not the case. Mind and spirit energy are altering in relationship to me moving this cup. Everything you do, every breath you take, is is there is an interplay with mind energy and spirit energy, not only within you, but in the universe of universes at large. It's a very, very amazingly complicated, fascinating system when you think about it that way. Okay, and that's very important now, because they're going to bring that to the fore, that reminder of how it's all together in a system, a triune system. It's that triune system, in fact, becomes literally tangibly manifest when a midwayer distills out of it. Right? That triune energy system, yeah, a midwayer coalesces out of it. Yeah. And we'll see that the parents of that midwayer start this complex interplay. All right. We've got this. Despite the fact that we're giving rise to primary midwayers and they're relatively the same on every world that has them, yes, primary midwayers, but the exact energy nature of them and the exact energy precursors of them varies from world to world. Okay.
It is well always to bear in mind that the successive bestowals of the sons of God on an evolving planet produced marked changes in the spiritual economy of the realm, and sometimes so modify the workings of the inner association of spiritual and material agencies on a planet as to create situations indeed difficult of understanding. The status of the 100 corporeal members of Prince Kalagash's staff illustrates just such a unique inner association. As ascendant Marantia citizens of Gerasim, they were super material creatures without reproductive prerogatives. As descendant planetary ministers on Urantia, they were material sex creatures capable of procreating material offspring, as some of them later did. What we cannot satisfactorily explain is how these 100 could function in the parental role on a supermaterial level, but that is exactly what happened. A supermaterial, non-sexual liaison of a male and a female member of the corporeal staff resulted in the appearance of the firstborn of the primary midwayers.
Okay. There you see, just very matter of fact, that it was a non-sexual liaison. But remember, back when they talked about that, with the prince's, in the paper about the prince's staff, the parenthetical there, instead of just being straightforwardly, in parentheses, non-sexual, there it was in parentheses, supposedly non-sexual and non-material, right? I remember we were chuckling about that because they were messing around materially. They were trying everything they could think of, having all kinds of fun exploring their physicality. Okay, the actual physical liaison, doesn't directly feed into the production of the primary midwares, like it does with the progenitors for the secondary midwares, etc.
Didn't they describe that also? And then that's when the prince told them, keep doing it.
They're about to talk about that again here. Yeah.
Frisky day.
Yeah. Yeah, that was. It was. Let's see. And it was during the 33rd year of their sojourn in Dalmatia, long before the wall was completed, that number 2 and number 7 of the Danite group accidentally, quote unquote, discovered a phenomenon. Right. yes. So. But here you see it, just in case you were still, holding out some sort of a a conspiracy theory or something there about that. It's like, no, it with the primaries, right, it's not, the actual physical sex is not causally, you know, directly involved. Even if maybe it has to be in play in order to get the proper mind and Marantia energy liaison to happen. Okay. All right. So there's that little thing. Then I'll go back to the beginning. So you notice the first thing that they say up front is just what I was stressing on the preceding paragraph. It is well always to bear in mind. See, and then they directly tell you what I was saying, that you have the whole physics of matter, mind, and spirit are shifted into a different mode when you start a new dispensation. You know, probably kind of the most significant for us to think about is this whole undescribed spirit energy aspect of this planet. You know, its whole mode of operation is switched into a different state when you start a different dispensation. Like I said, the spiritual economy, you know, so the laws of the house of spirit energy, see, take a different, you know, are rule governed by a different set of rules, see?
Been upgraded.
Right? They literally, the physics of the spirit energy system is, you know, shifted. Maybe not the internal nature, of the spirit energy, but at least the boundary conditions imposed upon that spirit energy system are changed, so that it's being directed in a different way. You can maybe even think it goes through some kind of a phase change or something, sort of, you know, in the same way that we saw with the evolution, biological evolution, that you'd have these suddenlies, these phase changes in the physical system.
Can you compare that to like hydrogen, oxygen becoming water, phase change, or?
Well, the hydrogen oxygen to water, a phase change is it has a bit of similarity to that super additive thing of hydrogen and oxygen coming together to make water, in that, there's this discontinuous jump, right, with the phase change, just like there's, you jump up to the super additive consequence. You know, you don't go through a whole bunch of intermediate, steps to get up to the result. You just jump up to some result with the super additive consequence. So, yeah, there is that non-gradually, step function, discontinuity sort of aspect to it. Yeah, that's similar. Saltation is is that term, which means jump. Yeah. Remember that happened when they switched dispensations after the dispensational resurrection tied to Jesus 2,000 years ago, right? There was this whole change in the whole physics of the planet 2,000 years ago in this regard. And the other thing they're adding in there, not just the energy, like I've been talking about, but remember there's agencies, right? There's all the beings that are managing all this. All those spirit controllers that they don't talk about, for instance, are directly involved here. Spiritual and material agencies. So between all this change, you can get, you have very different juxtapositions. You can get very different super additive consequences than you ever could have had before. All right. Let's see. What else do we have here? Reminding you, remember the main reason that they can do this is that they have an entire Marantia body that's been combined with a material body. So this very extensive Marantia energy system. So you have the mind overlapping, the mind liaison between the couple, the staff, and you have the Marantia energy systems overlapping. They mean literal liaison, and I mean you are literally putting these in intimate interplay, overlap, and so that there can be this super additive consequence. I think didn't they describe that back there? Yeah, they carefully explored every imaginable phase of intellectual mind and Marantia soul liaison. You know, that's how they said it back there. But of course, like I was just saying, it's not just merely the Marantia brain, you know, literally just the soul. I mean, they have an entire Marantia body. So this is a very significant overlap that occurs. And that's obviously the sort of the spark for it. All right, let's see. And then, but the other thing they're throwing in there is that the fact that they were made to be able to physically procreate, that apparently, changes the way mind attunes to them, so that when the mind overlaps, it's a different kind of a procreative mind overlap. What they're pointing out is also important for them to be procreators of a primary midware. The Marantia energy systems don't have sort of a procreative form to them. Right? They're like they pointed out there. You know, they don't have reproductive prerogatives, as they say there, right, on the Mansion Worlds or on Jerusalem. Even though that's kind of the primary energy overlap that's giving rise here, for it to be a procreative overlap, it needs to have this procreative mind. So that reminds you, it may seem like it's just purely a molecular thing going on when a male and a female procreate, right, and conceive of a baby. No. I mean, that man and that woman are overlapping their minds, and that's very much part of that procreative act. It's a way you can think of how the mother is very intimately involved in that. You know, when all is said and done, there's nothing coincidental about which sperm engaged an egg. Right? In every conception in the entire grand universe throughout all time, when all is said and done, it all ends up being just so. Right? It all seems to be just an accident from our perspective, but there is no such thing. Right? When all is said and done, like I've tried to point out, when all is said and done, there's nothing quote-unquote accidental or random or anything about the two oxygen molecules that just bounced off each other in front of my face, right? Or the two nitrogen molecules, or right? Everything, is completely encompassed and is part of a coordinated system of the universal mother. And all that is being played, as a vast orchestra. Right? Every automaton is being played as an instrument in a vast orchestra, producing that final harmony of the total finite. So, it's with these midway creatures that the fact that that's what I was just describing isn't just a poetic musing, right? The fact that it's literally what I was just saying, right, is made visible in the midway or coming into existence. Right? The fact that the mother is very intimately in play in all of this. All right. What we cannot so satisfactorily explain, see, because there's just, you don't have this dot to dot that they can follow analytically, right, and study. You're talking about it, you know, it's a phenomenon of the whole, not a phenomenon of parts that you can analyze and understand all of the how of it. Right? You can see, like, you know, is how, right? The science of it is inscrutable. Right? And that's, you know, whenever they say the inscrutable, you know, whatever, they're talking about some very holistic thing that it isn't just dot to dot with the parts. You know, but even, as I'm stressing, even though, you know, our science has studied a lot about conception, material conception, and, you know, and so much of it seems to be dot to dot of the parts, and you can analyze it and seemingly understand it. There's much more to it than just what analysis of parts discloses, right? In it, everything involves the whole. It's just sometimes the whole is very, very dominant in the phenomenon, you know, and the parts are recede into the background, and it just seems to come out of nowhere. Okay, so that's what's going on here. Very, very fascinating stuff to think about how the prince's staff, right, they're just fooling around physically, right? But they are stimulating this entire triune energy system that we're immersed in to give rise to this midware. You know, they're this catalytic agent, you know, in a very profound way. All right, what else do they give us here?
It was immediately discovered that a creature of this order, midway between the mortal and angelic levels, would be of great service in carrying on the affairs of the prince's headquarters. And each couple of the corporeal staff was accordingly granted permission to produce a similar being. This effort resulted in the first group of 50 midway creatures.
Okay, you know, kind of surprisingly, because we all know Galagastia, our planetary prince, is, you know, love to kind of explore the unexplored frontiers of of experiential reality. You know, he's very, you know, as we would say, conservative about this. Right? He doesn't just say, you know, go for it. You know, initially, okay, each of you do one, right? And we'll observe this for a while, see what the deal is. So just that also reminds you as I was saying, even though the primaries are quite, you know, in relative terms, precisely expressed on every world, there is a variability that requires examination. All right? So the prince... as each of them do just one to start with. And the other thing there reminded me of what I was going to mention in the first paragraph in the paper, and I forgot. The whole midway issue, you know, up there when they said existing on a life-functioning level about midway between those of the mortals of the realms and the angelic orders. You know, one little caveat there. There are so many times in the book when... you have to remind yourself that what is said very straightforwardly like that in black and white has a little invisible asterisk next to it, right? There's the unrevealed lower order of angels, right, that is not incorporated into sentences like that. They're midway between mortals and cherubim. Okay, But the unrevealed angels are right there in the midst of this midway space where the midwayers are. So you gotta keep that in mind. There's a number of things that are said that if you, once you are reminding yourself of that lower order of angels, you go, oh, wait a minute, I found an error in the book. Yeah, that's not true. No, I mean, remember, they're not allowed to reveal. So they actually have to write sentences that aren't precisely correct if you included the lower order of angels. Saying things like, the cherubim are the lowest order or something like that. You're like, well, okay, except for the order that you aren't allowed to reveal. And so always keep that in mind, that the sentences are relative to that limitation in them. Revelatory mandate. Relative to cherubim and mortals, there you're basically in between. With the primaries on the cherubim side of in between and secondary midwares on the human side of in between. All right. Let's see here. Maybe just one other little thing. Notice at the end of that preceding paragraph when it said the firstborn, that's never just a technicality. Right? There's always a significance to the first of an order of beings. They don't totally explain, but you can assume that very first one, would stand apart from the others in some way. Okay. We'll come back to that eventually. Okay. All right. So we've got 50, and they're observing them. So what's the deal here? What do they tell us next?
After a year of observing the work of this unique group, the Planetary Prince authorized the reproduction of midwares without restriction. This plan was carried out as long as the power to create continued, and the original core of 50,000 was accordingly brought into being.
Okay, they told us way back there that previous section in part two about the midwares, that you always have precisely 50,000 primaries on every world. Okay, so that is not a surprise. So you kind of wonder, well, why are they almost treating it like an experiment? I wonder how many we're going to produce. It's like, it's happened a gazillion times, and every time it's been 50,000, why would anyone expect anything else? Well, again, what are we saying? They never know. Maybe at some point in the evolution of the universe of universes, there's going to be a phase change in the, in the total finite, and suddenly on worlds, you won't have 50,000. You'll have 100,000 or something, or it could suddenly change. Right? But yet again, as it has every single time prior, there's exactly 50,000. And why is it appropriate to say the power to create rather than merely procreate? Can you answer that from what I've just been saying about the process?
Because the mother's involved.
Right, because there's an actual creator involved, right, the mother. Yes. Right. And all I was pointing out is, why it's appropriate to use the word procreate at all, even when it's just two clueless, young humans, getting together and conceiving a child. The mother's always involved. Right? I mean, that's, if the mother wasn't involved, it wouldn't be appropriate to even say procreate. Right? You say procreate because you're reminding yourself that a creator is working through you. You're not the ultimate source of what's going on there. No matter how much it appears that you are, you know, and just random hormones, you know, in the backseat of a car somewhere, you know, makes it happen. Okay? It's never really like that. It can't be. Right? Because we all exist. This distinction is vital. For in a cosmic system, the individual members, right, are not connected with each other except in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole. You can't have sex except in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole.
You know, that's why it's so important not to, you know, lose these children that are being conceived, because they're some very great purpose that they...
And that's why, you know, humans can't ultimately decide. We might appear to be, you know, playing God, but, you know, we can't really, right? That's... Right, you know, they're not really our children, right? And that the fact that they really aren't our children, no matter what you did to them, they appear on the probationary nursery, right? It proves that they really aren't your children, right? You're not a creator, right? You know, for them to be really your children, you'd need to be a creator. You're not a creator. You're a procreator. Creators are working through the. It's the creator's children, right? You're.
That
you're a means.
You think about abortions and stuff, how they get rid of all these babies, and then they have to. I wonder how upset, you know, God is. And the
well, again, you know, it happens on every world, right? I mean, it's a completely natural part of every world. It's not just our world. It isn't because of the rebellion and the default, right? On a totally normal world, you know, you have that. It's you know, they don't just have probationary nurseries for rebel worlds, you know. Okay. Now, the salvaged children of time come from every world, right? And if they're, you know, if the child, you know, is not, you know, actually aborted, you know, it maybe they're just, you know, they're birthed, but, you know, exposed to the elements and left to die, you know. Millions and millions and millions and millions of children on every world, right, make it to the Isle of Paradise via the probationary nursery, right? And why? Because the Isle of Paradise needs millions and millions and millions and millions of permanent inhabitants.
It's a big place.
Right, it's a very big place. That's how those permanent inhabitants of that order come into existence. You know, because some primitive couple, you know, for whatever reason, didn't want their child, and so, you know, shortly after it was born, they, you know, took it out in the, you know, in the desert and left it to die. But to their surprise, when they woke up in the first mansion world, they were told that their child is in the probationary nursery, the one that they left out in the desert to die. And the Spernaja are tired of changing diapers. It's your turn.
But even the same with the natural miscarriage, so to speak.
Right, yeah. That's what I'm saying. I mean,
even a conscious thing.
Right. It doesn't have anything to do with, you know, right. I mean, like, you know, like I've always pointed out, you know, it doesn't say the children, you know, after some point. It says all children before a point. You know, and what's that point? Okay. Even before birth, right, it says, right? Right, so...
And Gabriel knew who Jesus was the day of conception.
Right.
Pure to Mary.
Right, I mean, do we think that the incarnation of Michael, you know, in his seventh bestowal only began at birth? No, of course, it began at conception, right? Right, he was incarnated at conception. Because that's when something came to exist. Right. It's just
your thing about that, they could only have 1,000 each, right?
Yeah,
50,000.
1,000 each, right?
And you wonder why, you know, there's, as you say, it's probably just the way.
I was going to totally elaborate, because the next paragraph, right, they're going to talk about that a little bit more, right? You know, so we'll talk about that. You know, we'll speculate on that a little bit.
That's really handy that they had 50 couples. Just happened to have 50 couples.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, you can see this is the way it always works. You've got 100, you know, in a staff, and so there's 50 couples, and they each produce 1,000, and this is just the way it's always been working.
You know, they don't share with these couples the technique before they come.
well, again, see, because it's different on every world, right? The position that worked on world number 5 doesn't work on world number 68, right?
Or 69.
Right, we can all have lots of fun with this, but, right, I mean, it's just, that's, you know, that's the deal. It's all... I mean, how much more experimental is it going to be on an experimental world? But it's experimental on every world, you know, in that sense. Right? They just try it out. Because the whole, you know, energy system, the economy of the world is different. You know, and so you have to find the way. It's like, well, does the system resonate when I stimulate it like this? No. How about like this? No. I mean, you know, the individuals might be stimulated, but the system is not. Right, you have to find there's a certain way that you overlap the energy systems of the two individuals that stimulates the whole. There's this resonance in the whole system. You know, it's kind of like when you think about, you know, that mysterious stage and going from first circular to fusing. Right, you've climbed the whole cosmic ladder, as it were, and gotten up to first circular. And now there's this very mysterious step where you have to try to figure out how to synchronize and lock onto the adjuster. You know, and it, you know, we usually talk about it as just, well, there's your soul and there's the adjuster, and there it's just this relationship between the two, and they're trying to synchronize. You know, technically, they fuse when they figure out how to resonate with the whole. Right. It's not just as what it appears. This distinction is vital. It's the same. It's always that. Right? Until you find that resonance with the whole, through the individuality of the whole, there isn't any reality to what you're up to.
Yeah. Right? Two individual members.
Yeah. So it's just, that's so important. You know, think about how, you know, what you're trying to do to be effective in anything in life. You know, you're trying to find that way of functioning where you have this resonance with the whole system. Then and only then does it last, what you've done. And it's, when it resonates with the system, it's upheld by the system. And it doesn't resonate with the system, it's not upheld by the system, right? It has to have that systemic quality to it, or it can't be held by the individuality of the whole, right? There's no individuality of the parts inside holding up parts. Right? The individuality of the parts is the Father, is outside. Right? In order for stuff to be upheld, it has to be innately in resonance with the whole. All right. Okay, so let's see. Did we get everything there? Okay, yeah, just a reminder before we go to the next paragraph. So they spent a whole year observing. Okay. And then, you know, our prince said, all right, go for it. All right, so then how did this, you know, now they're going to give us the details, how we got from 50 to 50,000. Yep.
John Stevens is asking, is the consciousness of the whole what the complement of the tree of life and other forces?
I mean, definitely, I mean, that's something to consider when you try to figure out the inscrutable physics of the relationship of the fruit of the tree of life to whoever's using it. You know, remember how I pointed out that every time they mention it, it's kind of spoken of in a slightly different way. See, actually, it's a very systemic phenomenon, And you can look at it in part-wise fashion in different ways. If you look at it this way, you got this sentence in the book. And if you look at it another way, you've got this sentence in the book. And the two sentences don't really seem to be saying it, talking about the same thing. So it appears, because it isn't really some simple part-wise thing. It's a very systemic phenomenon. Yeah. Yeah, very much. And, you know, we're seeing, you know, the fact that you get these systemic beings, these midwayers, produced by a prince's staff or by Adam and Eve and crew. I just, you need that kind of innate ability to resonate with the whole system to make such a systemic thing happen. You know, Bob and Nancy, you're just not going to do it. Right? I mean, none of us, we're just way too part-like right now. None of us embody such a resonance with a whole, you know, that, you know, just two mortals are ever going to produce a midwayer. Yeah.
I don't want to derail anything, but how would, based on everything we've talked about, things like genetics, modification, how does that tie in? Is this kind of, we have to come up with a resonant way to do it, or...
So initially you'll have genetic engineering that is kind of what humans right now can sort of imagine. There's a whole bunch of part-wise issues that need to be fixed first, right? You know, the bolts aren't in the right place, you know, on the alternator, right? I mean, it's just very straightforward. Okay, but once you fix all of the part-wise defects, right, then... the, you know, millennia, almost endless millennia of, you know, of genetic engineering that goes way deep into light and life, right? More and more you are fine-tuning this so it has greater and greater resonance with the whole.
A good first step would be acknowledging the spiritual economy and the mind all, the existence and influence on the system as well.
Yeah, see, so obviously, you know, you have to have an understanding not just of physical energy systems, you know, to a very deep level, but of mind energy systems and spirit energy systems, and then the three together in a triune system to even know what these, you know, fine little adjustments are about that you're making in the third stage of light and life. Right? Very, very subtle things that, you know, are just almost completely transcendent of any part-wise issues. Right? So, yeah, just think all you can. There's just I'm speaking about a very general fact. So you can kind of go to any area and bring this holistic thinking into that science. Yeah. It's true in everything. Through gravity, you know, you name it, everything, right, has to have this holistic perspective brought into it. Right, and the genetic engineering is in that boilerplate. They've got to figure it out anew on every world. Yeah, it's different on every world. The whole process. If it was boilerplate, there wouldn't be another world. Right. The whole point of having yet another world is that it's not like any other world. Everything is new. Behold, all things have become new on this new world. Right, because it's all shades of. You go to the central universe, there's a billion worlds. Everyone is completely different. Right? On the most minute details, you can't find, oh, that's just the same as on the previous world. It's completely different. From the deepest microscopic to the biggest macroscopic, the world is completely different. Right? Just totally mind-boggling what that means, right? But you know that's the case, right? So that gets expressed. That's the pattern universe. That gets expressed out here. And there's just this endless diversity that has to be explored. There's no manual in advance that they all follow, right? It is all carried out interactively, experientially, empirically, and on every world. Well, let's try this. Well, that didn't work. Well, let's try this. Right? And then, like we pointed out, the very existence of decimal worlds is part of that. Right? Every 10 worlds, roughly, they need to do a little test so they can get a little bit of sense of where the whole is. Because you can't just think about the parts. The parts are inescapably part. You know, so you have to do a little test. Okay, what kind of a influence does the whole have now? Right? If you waited 30 worlds, the change, you know, the evolution of the whole would be so significant that, you know, your what you do with the parts would be totally off whack. You know, it wouldn't work. You know, you can't just, you figured it out on this world, right? And now you can just keep doing the same, right? It's just like with you. You figured out something when you were 20, and then you think, oh, well, now I can just think that way the rest of my life. No, the entire universe is evolving. Right? What might have been valid when you were 20 is no longer valid. Because you've changed, everyone else has changed, the world's changed, the universe changed, everything's changing.
That's that great bumper.
Right? It's just, you know, it's not just, you know, and it's not just that. Yeah, but there's a literal fact that, you know, it's not just the ignorance of that teenager, right? I mean, you know, you can be a perfecter of wisdom, far transcendent of an ignorant human teenager. You can be a perfecter of wisdom, and you can figure out exactly how it needs to be done, and then the whole universe changes on you. You've got to start from scratch and figure it all out again. That's the way the whole universe is.
Calibration.
There are some things that are not changing.
Right, the existential is changeless, right? But all the experiential is ever changing. Right? There's only one being that's purely existential, the Universal Father. Everything else, you know, I mean, the other two persons, yeah, they have existential cores, but they have experiential natures too. There's Mother Deity in the second and third persons, right? Right, and you know, that's the fact that everything is changing, and yet the whole human history of thinking about God is believing that the Universal Father is something that changes, and or even that you can change. I'm going to pray and change the Father. No, the Father's purely existential, absolutely changes, and there's not one iota in any way, shape, or form that can change.
And then there's somewhere else, everything else is nothing but change.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is great, because otherwise
it's
boring.
Now, if there wasn't one fact that was changeless, how would you know that everything else was changing, right? There has to be a reference point, right? All change has to be relative to something that's changeless. All motion has to be relative to something that's motionless, etc. You know, he cuts himself off from any possibility of changing so that something can change. Right? He's the reference point for everything else to be able to change.
It's one little point in the middle.
Yes. One little, right, sequestered point in the middle of everything, yeah. The core of the Father.
You're so tiny.
Right.
Yeah, he's really good at being small.
Right. If he wasn't, you know, as you just said, really good at being small, right, he would be everything, right? For the universe to be big, he has to be small.
See, there's something to be said for being small.
Yeah. okay, meanwhile, back to the details of how we got to 50,000 primary midwares.
A period of 1/2 year intervened between the production of each midware and when 1,000 such beings had been born to each couple, no more were ever forthcoming. And there is no explanation available as to why this power was exhausted upon the appearance of the 1,000th offspring. No amount of further experimentation ever resulted in anything but failure.
So, you know, see how humbling it is, how obvious it is that Okay, yeah, they're procreating, but wow. I mean, this seems like very much just creation, right? And, you know, incidentally, they're a conduit for it, right? Or maybe they're not even hardly a conduit. Maybe they're just kind of the catalyst, like I was saying, see? It's obviously the mother is orchestrating all of this. I mean, you know, it's not that they only do whatever it is that they do, monkey around, you know, every 6 months. No, they're doing it, you know, 50 times a day, but nothing happens until half a year later, and then all of a sudden, today, you know, at this hour, it works. And boom, there's another primary midwife. Obviously, the mother is coordinating, orchestrating the whole phenomenon. You know, and what's the fit? Obviously, there's all kinds of physics to it, right? Why a half a year?
Can we read between the lines here and also see that there's a 500-year period where they were just kind of, this was going on for 500.
Yeah, you know, and after the thousands, you know, you get to think, well, maybe this is the first world where we get more than 50, so we don't want to stop, we don't want to assume.
Yeah.
So they very dutifully keep it up. Dear, we got to check again. Yeah, yeah.
Well, or they think the experiment is switching partners to see if they
can. I don't know, boy. That's not. Yeah. You see,
I would think. They want an experiment.
Yeah, experiment. Well, they're not. No, I mean, we're joking about it and stuff, you know, with our Mori system and stuff. But you know, John has got a great point. I mean, you know, you read this and you go, well, it seems like they paired up and stuck to the pairs. It doesn't seem to be any hint like, well, I mean, so what's the deal with that? Is there something bigger in play where there's nothing sort of arbitrary about these 100, that they're actually 50 pairs are selected to begin with, see? And, you know, and then they would, you know, they're given orders to not go outside that pair. I mean, is there some bigger thing in play? I mean, is part of the rebellion, you know, to, you know, when they start procreating, do they just, you know, do they break their pairs? You know, if the pair wasn't already broken because one was a rebel and one wasn't, you know, maybe. But yeah, we don't know. But you can see, and your first thought is, well, if, you know, 50 pairs have tried it, I mean, think about all the different combinations, right?
Yeah.
There's you and the 49 others, right? You know. I haven't tried out yet. but you get the sense that they didn't do that, you know. I maybe, you know, the final thing, no amount of further, okay, maybe there, but my first suspicion is that there's some bigger thing going on with the pairing thing that they never explain.
But they do talk about where they come from, so to speak. You know, hardly any of them came from the same. You know, they didn't really know each other that well in the beginning.
Right. I mean, there's all that. Yeah, there's coming from all kinds of different source worlds and stuff.
Exactly.
But, you know, even here, you know, what I read, it was number 2 and number 7 of the Danai group. It's like, well, okay, that's kind of, I mean, wouldn't, if they were paired in advance, wouldn't it be like number 2 and number, no, not even that, 1 and 2, you know, or 3 and 4? They don't explain all this. See? There's a lot of mysterious things here.
What about true monogamy is more civilized than having a free-for-all?
Right. I mean, you know, so then you bring in them as cultural influence. Now you could say, well, none of the evolutionary mortals, you know, are going to be aware of any of this. But still, they, you know, if they're playing around in pairs, they're probably working in pairs.
Lottery system.
Uh-oh, not the lottery system again. but they don't explain.
Rebellion, I mean, you would have... Nothing more happened after the rebellion, so it doesn't seem like, you know, that they once they're, okay, we're not following the rules, now we're going to pair up with different people. Like, that
didn't but they procreated, you know, they birthed as many children, you know, after the rebellion as they could, you know, as we're about to read here with the Noddites, you know,
but there's no
more no midwares, no.
Yeah, yeah. So if they were doing true monogamy before the rebellion, and then the rebellion happened, and then they could be free to pair with whoever they wanted, then it would have been, you know, if that was...
But again, there's no way, you know, once they've rebelled, you know, the whole, their whole, you know, balanced relationship to the system has been broken, and, you know, I mean, they can't, you know, just literally can't produce a midway anymore. They don't have that, you know, synchronization of the whole anymore. You know, they've severed it, just like Adam and Eve are immediately severed, you know, when they defaulted from having this deep, penetrating synchronization with the whole like they had before.
And then they became part of the orgy.
This is pretty early on in the Dalmatia.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is right. I mean, remember what I said back there. How did they word that? It was during their 33rd year of their sojourn, long before the wall was completed. So, I mean, right. This is very early on that they got started on this. So, but you know, just one more last thought. You know that they would be modeling monogamy, right? Yeah. You know, but I have a suspicion, you know, there's probably something more literal, energetic about their pairing as opposed to just modeling, you know, for the mortals, you know, like Jesus modeling prayer for the mortals, you know. It's like, well, I'm not really doing this for myself, but I'm just kind of going through the motions to model it for you, you know. I mean, I'm sure it's more than just modeling like that for the mortals.
Don't they also, in that previous paper, they mentioned that if everything had gone according to plan, they were also supposed to procreate a material successor being. So that might also have something.
Right. I mean, you know, I mean, there's, and we're going to get to that here with the Noddites, you know, they'll mention that again. But remember, every prince's staff procreate before they leave. You know, so that's a normal part of the process. But we'll get to the specialness of their, how the life carriers designed their physical procreation phenomenon on this world. Okay, all right, so back to this. Let's see, did we get everything there? So you've got this mysterious every half year. It happens. Stops at 1,000 for each couple. You know, you notice how they go a little farther than they often do. They don't just say there's no explanation, like they sometimes speak so definitively, like, you know, you just can't know this. This is no explanation available, right? They do know that someone understands this, right? But they're not talking. You know, and it's just like so many things. Like, you remember, you know, even at the highest level of master architects, right? It works this way, right? There's a certain number, right, that can come into existence, and then you have literally, you know, actualized all that type of potential, right? And there'll never be another actualization because there's no potential to actualize, right? Think of the potential literally. You've used the last drop of potential. So once the potential's gone, no actuality is possible. So they've literally plumbed the depths in this little narrow mode of the total finite. That measure, that type of potential in the total finite has just been bottomed out, drained dry. Okay, what else do they say?
These creatures constituted the intelligence core of the prince's administration. They ranged far and wide, studying and observing the world races and rendering other invaluable services to the prince and his staff in the work of influencing human society remote from the planetary headquarters.
Okay, now that bit is the usual mode. You know, it it says back there in, what is that again, paper 38, on normal worlds, the primary midwayers maintain their service as the intelligence corps and as celestial entertainers, for visitors. You know, they handle the visitors that come in behalf of the planetary prince. That part, even though all these details are different on this world, in terms of that basic functioning, they serve as the prince's intelligence corps. So they're out, you know, they go over to North America and South America and are spying on, you know, or whatever. They're figuring out what's going on, you know, long before, you would even have people in North America, right? They would have scoped that out, and they'd be keeping an eye on it, you know, forming the prince. Right? So the prince would be making plans for, you know, way in advance before Red Man goes across, you know, and comes over, all that sort of, you know. So they're helping him kind of keep the whole world in mind, what animals are where, and because the humans need animals to hunt, and you know what areas are decent farming land, and all that sort of stuff. They would be keeping the prince informed about all that. Not to mention, they can do, apparently not totally easily, but they can do material things if they need to. So this whole bit of work of influencing human society, that could take on something very materially literal, if it needed to. These people are migrating and they're thinking of going this way. But they get there and there's a rock slide that's, you know, buried that path. So, well, I guess we can't go that way. We'll have to find another way to go. Right. They literally could be doing stuff like that, you know, like angels and stuff can get involved and tweak things to kind of manage what humans are up to in an indirect way. And remember, they were going to help out with Adam and Eve getting, right? being able to do such things. Remember that, you know, getting to what was going on with the people wanting to worship everyone to get them there quickly. They did help out. All right, what is the final little thing they say here?
This regime continued until the tragic days of the Planetary Rebellion, which ensnared a little over 4/5 of the primary midwayers. The loyal corps entered the service of the Melchizedek receivers, functioning under the titular leadership of Van until the days of Adam.
Yeah, we'll get to that, you know, a little over 4/5.
That's a lot.
It's literally 40,119. Wow. Remember? Less than 10,000, you know, that stayed loyal. And of course, that 40,119 were taken off at Pentecost. Right? But they were here until Pentecost, up to mischief. As we'll read in a little bit, you know, in this paper. Okay, so and remember how, back when we read about the rebellion, how this titular leadership, Van, was, you know, kind of in charge, and there was that whole group, and right, they even mentioned that lesser order of angels, remember, was mentioned in passing there, you know, the person in charge of them, and Van kind of coordinating everything with all that. So, yep, that... And so, you know, in that regard, right, we all know, we kind of just reminded, that takes you all the way forward to Adam and Eve's time, you know, with Van and Amnon just carrying on like that in relationship to those midwayers. So now they want to drop back again. It's like, well, you've got the midwayers going forward there to Adam and Eve's time. What about the prince's staff? What about the rebel prince's staff? Right, so that's what the next section's about.
Number 2, the Nodite race. While this is the narrative of the origin, nature, and function of the midway creatures of Urantia, the kinship between the two orders, primary and secondary, makes it necessary to interrupt the story of the primary midwayers at this point in order to follow out the line of descent from the rebel members of the corporeal staff of Prince Caligastia from the days of the planetary rebellion to the times of Adam. It was this line of inheritance which in the early days of the second garden furnished one half of the ancestry for the secondary order of midway creatures.
Right, as we all know, and eventually you've got that Noddite, Rada, getting together with Adamson. So we have this very exceptional phenomenon on this planet, that there is this linkage between the primaries and secondaries. So it's not surprising that when all is said and done after Pentecost, the primaries and the secondaries would come together as one group. See, they're sort of kindred spirits, if you will, to begin with, just by by how they came to be.
Bring me back to another question. Yep. When they talk about four fists. Mm-hmm. You know, they had 40,000 bad on one side, 10,000 mm-hmm. on the other, and yet they didn't get control of the tree of life. Mm-hmm. You know, they weren't able to overtake the other group.
Yeah.
You know, and they way outnumbered them with beings that could do a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, you wonder, and there may be, you mentioned earlier, something that when they went into rebellion, something that curtailed their ability to be able to, overcome that other situation to that degree.
Yeah, I mean, it obviously is not as we would think. It's like, well, okay, I mean, it's, it's 4-1 here. I mean, if you just look at it like that, it looks like the loyals are going to lose. But you've got power beings, physical power beings, spirit power beings, right, there's all of these things that they don't really talk about.
On one side.
Right, that are only on the good side. Right, so, that's why no matter how big the rebellion, even a system-wide rebellion, it's going to lose, because it's when all is said and done, it's just a handful of parts against the whole, right? And the whole always wins, just like the house always wins, right? the house of the finite will always win, right? I mean, no little personal purposive thing can overwhelm the personal purposiveness of the universal mother ubiquitously throughout the entire finite. All of us have to recognize, put ourselves in cooperative subordination to that big picture, because no matter how much you might want something, when all is said and done, right, I mean, you're not the boss, right? The whole wins. And again, that's, you have to recognize, that's what's so different about the fifth epical revelation to prior epical revelations about the Father. One of the things they tell you about the Universal Father in the fifth is the first thing the Universal Father did when he came into existence was put himself in cooperative subordination to the whole. You mean there's something bigger? Yeah, he put himself in cooperative subordination to the first thing that's bigger. Right, there's stuff even bigger than the Paradise Trinity. The whole is vastly bigger than even the biggest part, the Universal Father. The Trinity Infinite is infinitely bigger than the infinity of the Universal Father.
If there's a difference between infinity being bigger than infinity.
Right? There's infinite, and then there's infinite. Right? Right, the apex of infinity is the Trinity Infinite. All the other infinities are within that context. That is the context. And so, right, it's all that, that just comes down, and we need to all recognize it. And to delight in that, is that not good news? That no matter how much it appears like you're a lonely island universe part and no one cares, there is no such thing. Everything is within the whole. Right? The only way to not be in the whole is to not exist. If you exist, you're within the context of a whole. A whole hierarchy of wholes. Right?
You couldn't love if there wasn't a whole.
Yeah, you could, nothing could happen, right? So it's just to, what great news that is, right? That, and just knowing that no matter how much it seems like you have a very unfortunate renegade phenomenon that humans are doing, no, it's all in the context of the whole. No matter what you do, no matter how selfish, no matter how gross, disgusting, tangential, it's all within the whole. It'll all be used to good. It doesn't mean that you don't have some responsibility as an individual, right? Don't put that in a dichotomy. It's like, oh, well, if there's always a whole, then it'll always make something about whatever I do. Why don't I just be totally selfish? And no, right? Right? You have a duty as an individual. But still, to not be so hard on yourself when you recognize in retrospect, I could have done a better job there. I could have been kinder, to that person or whatever. Don't beat yourself up. It's okay, right? Right? The whole will do wonderful things with that limited act that you did.
Doesn't mean you'll grow.
But the fact that you recognized it means you're going to try better the next time, right? Your insight into that allowed you to go forward with some wisdom from that tribulation.
Be perfect.
Yeah.
That's one thing about the Trinity Infinite.
Yep.
I love just mentioning it. I've always considered it like a sigh of relief, like a gentle womb sigh of relief. It's like, place to rest.
Yeah, right. It is that all find rest within that space. Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah. Okay. We won't get through this whole section. This is a great big section here, but get in a little ways here. Let's see. Let's make sure we get off on these tangents and make sure we haven't left anything about this first paragraph here. It was just about the we got everything here. So that let's go to this is a very interesting paragraph here that they throw in.
The physical members of the prince's staff had been constituted sex creatures for the purpose of participating in the plan of procreating offspring embodying the combined qualities of their special order united with those of the selected stock of the Andon tribes, and all of this was in anticipation of the subsequent appearance of Adam. The life carriers had planned a new type of mortal embracing the union of the conjoint offspring of the prince's staff with the first generation offspring of Adam and Eve. They had thus projected a plan envisioning a new order of planetary creatures whom they hoped would become the teacher rulers of human society. Such beings were designed for social sovereignty, not civil sovereignty. But since this project almost completely miscarried, we shall never know what an aristocracy of benign leadership and matchless culture Urantia was thus deprived of. For when the corporeal staff later reproduced, it was subsequent to the rebellion, and after they had been deprived of their connection with the life currents of the system.
Okay, so let's start with the bookends of that paragraph. You know, we'll get to this special thing they're talking about in the middle here in a little bit. But first of all, just the basics of, okay, so you get to them just doing the physical thing that we all understand and procreating, okay? But see, again, they're reminding you, it's so much more than meets the eye to that phenomenon of conceiving a baby. And when you have an even more significant non-material, you know, energy individual involved in the procreative act, you can observe this very directly, right? That there's a lot more than just molecules that feed forward into the procreated child. Right? There's a whole energy liaison that's going on that they're talking about there. And once they're severed from the bigger picture, no matter how much, you know, you have the material part functioning just exactly like it would have before the rebellion, right? It's not like their genetics suddenly decayed or something. I mean, their genetics is you know, hasn't changed one iota from the rebellion to the time they start procreating. But you don't get the kind of result that you would have because you aren't feeding this greater energy liaison into the phenomenon. So it's just very interesting to think about how much of that's going on when any two of us procreate. Right? How much is there... You know, much more than meets the eye to that phenomenon. It's just, you know, the fact that there is so much more to it, it's no wonder that until roughly age 16, the biologic child is still mindily connected to the parents because the mind is involved in the process to begin with, see. It's not like, you know, it's just a physical thing and then it gets plugged into mind. No, I mean, the mind was involved. The child's mind is being procreated just like his body is being procreated. Hey. Isn't it fascinating to think about how much more wonderful this is, you know, what's happening there? All right, so you're seeing them speaking to that the combined qualities, as they say at the beginning there, the combined qualities of their special order. And so all the energies involved with them, you know, plus you've got the andon, which is, you know, nature, which is very different, involved in the mix. Okay. All right. So that in itself is would be an interesting new thing, you know, relatively new thing, for, you know, compared to most worlds. But the life carriers dialed it up another notch. Okay. They planned on, you know, not just having those offspring of the staff, you know, for when the staff leaves, but they were going to mate them with the first generation of Adam and Eve's children. Okay, and that goes back to what we were thinking about with Adam and Eve. It's like, oh, we were wondering, you know, if on some worlds, maybe you kind of just have, I mean, Adam and Eve are different, but immediately the first generation and every subsequent generation are kind of all the same. You know, but here it seemed like this first generation was kind of only, you know, down halfway, you know, and you didn't kind of get down to the run-of-the-mill evolutionary stock until the second generation and beyond. Yes, because they designed it that way. They wanted that first generation to be a notch up because they weren't really going to be mating with the humans. They were going to be mating with the prince's staff. See? So now you finally get the rest of the picture brought in. Yeah, so that was part of the whole design. So see, the life carriers, you know, are designing the prince's staff with this in mind. They're designing the bodies of Adam and Eve with this in mind, exactly how Adam and Eve procreate, so that all this fits together. You know, and then that also reminds you, which we already, you know, one of the things we knew that kind of hinted at Adamson, you know, and the other first generationers being kind of a notch up, is that you could produce secondary midwares, right, from Adamson. See, again, they're a notch up. So here you see it, you know, very obviously between the lines here, when they bring up this aristocracy that they had planned.
Yeah.
You know, and of course that, you know, it's delightful to think about just them using the word aristocracy and how much that challenges political correctness in this day and age. I'm not going to be under any aristocracy. no one percenters are going to tell me what to do. I'm not going to recognize their social sovereignty. Right.
These would be true aristocracy. They would really have this leadership ability. They could see the whole.
Yeah.
They could move us forward in artistic way, in a true way.
Wouldn't just be a monetary.
Yeah, see, and you get this sense of, oh, and they're going to really establish kind of a parallel line, see, that aren't going to be, you know, mating with the main evolutionary stream. So their original plan, see, was to have this kind of parallel line going along probably for a long time, you know, as an aristocracy apart, genetically, right? Until sometime down the road they'd blend them together.
Well, and it is also, that distinction actually is important too, the social sovereignty, not civil sovereignty.
Yeah, yeah.
That is, because we do think of aristocrats as thinking they're entitled to civil sovereignty.
Yeah. But, and so when you think through it like that, it's like, huh. So, you know, it's not that strange that we have these non-dispensational revelations on this planet, where both, you know, with both the third epical and the fifth epical, there's two modes to them. Yes, they are there to supply a reinforcement to the main evolutionary stream, but in both cases, they're trying to set up a parallel stream, right? Machaventa did it with the Kenites. Right? The fifth epical revelation is definitely trying to do it. I mean, so much of it, you know, in many ways, in terms of the humans that are really relating to it directly, are the parallel stream. Right? You sort of are enlightened by it and then set it down and go into the main evolutionary stream, right, as an influence, right? But, you know, the book itself is just, you know, is not, it's not synchronized with the main evolutionary stream, right? But it can be the thread for that parallel stream. See, the one that they had planned from the beginning, there's always supposed to have been this parallel stream. See, isn't that interesting, see, that coincidentally, right, right, the truth of what they had planned from the beginning is trying to be reinforced by Machaventa and now by the revelators in this case. There needs to be this parallel stream, right, that stand apart from the slowly evolving ignorance of the main evolutionary stream. Right? You know, and it can't go to their heads, right? You know, despite the literalness of the word aristocracy, right? The rule of the best.
Curious, they say project almost completely.
Yeah, right. The fact that, you know, this did play out a little bit, you know, they're pointing out there's even a little bit of a genetic predicate for this parallel stream. Not the big one that they had planned, obviously, but nonetheless. So, see, it brings it full circle, you know, and it kind of reinforces, you know, if you want to really be hands-on with this revelation, you know, what it is that you're supposed to be about. You have the courage to step out of the evolutionary stream, right, and try to set up this parallel stream that's supposed to be here. You know, and leaders for the main evolutionary stream can come from that parallel stream. That's what the fifth epical revelation directly is trying to do, is be the thread of leadership that there's always supposed to have been. See, apparently, even if everything had gone totally as planned, no rebellion, no default, the genetics of this world is such that it needs a parallel stream of leadership. The life carriers aren't setting it up that way just for yucks and giggles. I wonder what will happen if we do this. Right? It's a whole system. There's supposed to be this. So this is a very, I mean, like I said, this paragraph, the more you unpack it, it's like, wow, this is a very consequential paragraph for what it's telling about the fundamental nature of this world. How this world needs to be set up if it's really going to kind of find its synchronization with the cosmos again that it lost 200,000 years ago. Yeah.
Both of these emergency revelations are coordinated somehow with the fourth epical revelation. Jesus coming out of turn, in a sense, because one before he came and now one after he came.
Yeah.
And
roughly 2,000 years before and roughly 2,000 years after, yes.
I'm talking about how the spiritual economy changes with the dispensation.
Right.
And there's a causal relationship. Well, Jesus coming out of turn set up a spiritual economy here.
Right.
That is extremely unusual.
Yes, extremely unusual, yes. Yeah. Yeah, so see, just think about all of that, see, and that it's in that very extremely unusual, spiritual economy and all the other energies as well, that's in place, in this new dispensation post-Jesus, it's in that context, that energy context, that the truth of the fifth epical revelation is supposed to manifest and roll forward. Right? It's supposed to find a synchronization with that economy. It has to be in a new wineskin. See, very much. Right? Just think about how inappropriate it is if you're applying this kind of thinking about the pre-Jesus spiritual economy. Where, for instance, you can't take your salvation for granted. Right? In this spiritual economy, you can take your salvation for granted. The physics has totally changed. Right? But you still see people, reading this book, like Jesus didn't even come. Like all you have is the Hebrew scriptures. Right? And you're trying to figure out how in the heck you can be saved. What you need to do. That spiritual economy is gone. Right? Remember we touched upon that spiritual economy, the physics of all that. Now you can actually, like if you're a first circle, you can go to the first mansion world, right? Instead of waiting for a group resurrection, you can go as an individual. Right? The whole spiritual physics didn't allow that before. Right. Again, we don't understand what the heck the details are there, but right, it's obviously very literal. Whatever's involved in that literally couldn't be done. Right? You needed certain spirit stuff or arrangement of stuff or whatever, and it wasn't there. So, you really need to think big picture about this new wineskin. It's not just your philosophic frame of reference. I mean, you got to think about the whole context of the world around you that you're supposed to be synchronizing with. Something that's totally different than it was 2,000 years ago.
Yes.
Yep.
One thing about setting up a parallel stream, you have to be really humble and careful about even thinking of it as being a setter-upper.
Yeah, yeah. And like I said, obviously that's ripe for delusional issues, isn't it?
It's
yeah.
Kind of slippery.
It's a very dicey thing.
Like, we can't think where it.
No. But, you know, you've got it.
Maybe we will be.
But obviously, boy, I'm going to need to keep an eye fixed on that humble, favorable condition, aren't I? If I think I'm going to participate properly in what I'm really supposed to be doing, if I'm going to have this book in my lap and I'm going to have it as a living part of my ministry. Right? I mean, if I'm going to just go out with a living faith, okay, I don't need the book. Right, and I'm an ambassador of the fourth epical revelation as I go out with my living faith. But if I'm going to go, you know, if I'm going to be in intimate, you know, interplay with this book, okay, you can't synchronize with the main evolutionary stream in that mode. Right, there's a dissonance between this and the right, that main evolutionary stream is not, you know. Looking for someone, does not need someone to tell them that their prayer is an abomination, right, or something like that, you know, or that, there's so many things in here that are just so inappropriate, right, for the main evolutionary stream, right, or, you know, just the stuff that, you know, it says about, you know, the history of what people have thought about the effectiveness of the effect of God, you know, in curing them and things. You know, when you're reading about evolutionary religion, I mean, those things are just it is so inappropriate to upset the main evolutionary stream from where it is with their belief in the God notion and the effect of that God in their lives and the interplay with that God. I mean, yeah, big picture objectively, right, they aren't related to a real God. It's all just, you know, consciously, internally inside of them, and, you know, their mind is curing their body and all this. Okay, but that, you absolutely should not be telling them that. It's, I mean, they're still in the mode where they need to be progressed in spite of themselves. There's a whole bunch of progressing in spite of oneself that must precede you progressing because of yourself. And you can't short-circuit that. You know, you're effectively a rebel if you think you have a right to short-circuit that child of God and somehow magically turn them into an adult of God.
That's millstone business.
Right, that's millstone business, right. Yeah. See, it's just, it's a very, you know, I try to bring this out a lot. I mean, just talking, you know, broadcasting to whoever, you know, is an interesting thing to be doing. I mean, the only reason I continue to do it, not knowing who might be listening, is I know that in general, they'll immediately not find any resonance with it and will stop listening. Right? It'll be just too weird or just, you know, too whatever. So, you know, I think most individuals self-filter on this.
Yeah.
But technically, right, it's very problematic to unpack this book to a child of God that isn't ready. I mean, the child of God can ignorantly read it and not find any tension because they really aren't unpacking it. They're just skimming its surface. And it all looks like mirrors, right? And they just see themselves and where they are.
They didn't violate
but if you actually unpack it, right, it's you know, it's a fillet knife stuck, you know, on one end and slices all the way up to the other, right? It's just a total evisceration of everything that you hold dear in that old evolutionary mode. You have to have the courage to just blow that all up, right? And humbly recognize that, you know, you're in serious need of some better ideas of God and whatnot, right? And everyone is kind of inescapably delusional, and it's very rugged stuff. Anyway, here we see kind of, you know, where they explicitly bring out this interesting tension that they had always planned to set up on this world. It's a two-stream world by design. Isn't that interesting? A normal world is a one-stream world. All right, let's see if we can get a little bit more here.
The post-rebellion era, is that where we're at?
Yep, that's where we are. Where were we?
Sorry.
That's where we are, yes.
The post-rebellion era on your rancho witnessed many unusual happenings. A great civilization, the culture of Dalmatia, was going to pieces. The Nephilim, or Nodites, were on Earth in those days. And when these sons of the gods went in to the daughters of men, and they bore to them their children were the mighty men of old, the men of renown. While hardly sons of the gods, the staff and their early descendants were so regarded by the evolutionary mortals of those distant days. Even their stature came to be magnified by tradition. This, then, is the origin of the well-nigh universal folktale of the gods who came down to earth and there, with the daughters of men, begot an ancient race of heroes. And all this legend became further confused with the race mixtures of the later appearing Adamites in the second garden.
Okay, so we think we left kind of paralleling Genesis behind. The last we touched upon was chapter 5. Now we're to chapter 6 in Genesis, and we have this little parallel. That's the quote unquote. You know, you're just in advance of Noah, the story of Noah in Genesis. And there's that very mysterious Nephilim reference there. The revelators are saying, okay, well, as an initial thing, you know, instead of going off on some weird tangent like everyone has done for thousands of years, with trying to rationalize who the Nephilim are, fallen angels or whatever. Start with directly think of them as the Nodites, right? And just interpret that passage as the Nodites engaging the evolutionary peoples. Notice that they, you know, besides adding that little parenthetical to basically just a, you know, direct lifting of that passage out of Genesis, you know, they also put quotes within quotes there, you know, the quote-unquote mighty men of old, the quote-unquote men of renown, you know, just as quote-unquote the sons of the gods, you know, they weren't literally as grand as history has made them out to be, mythology has made them out to be. They aren't that mighty. But we all know they quickly came to be thought that way, and, you know, and as they're pointing out, many people mythologize this way. You know, if you're, you know, into the Greek mythology, you know, what's an example of, you know, a mighty man, who Zeus came down and, you know, engaged, was always engaging females, and you get someone like?
Aphrodite.
Starts with an H? Oh. Hercules, right? Right. Right. I mean, you know, like they point out, everyone's got those stories of, you know, at least someone, you know, of the gods like Zeus, you know, fooling around with human females all the time, and, you know, and we get all these mighty men out of it, like Hercules. You know, and a lot of times, you know, they even translate them as the giants, you know, rather than the Nephilim. You know, like that, like they're saying, even their stature came to be magnified by tradition. And, you know, there's other things in the Old Testament that kind of touch at this, because obviously for a long time you've got tribes in that area that are, you know, still have a bit of an Andite, you know, maybe going back to Nodite, sort of genetics to them, and stand apart a little bit until finally everyone kind of completely blends together. So, you know, there's often tribes mentioned in the Old Testament that the scholars can tell if they're not literally like the Nephilim, quote unquote, they're sort of quasi Nephilim, you know, and you know, in some way kind of giants. So there's a you know, the existence of the Nodites, and then the Adamites, you know, and the blending in that colors, you know, the way those stories are told, and it feeds into mythology. Okay, let's see. I mean, obviously, if they wanted to, you know, think of Adam and Eve as gods, you know, that whole incident. Right, they're going to think of these as the sons of the gods, and you definitely have all, you know, a lot of stories where it starts out, you know, the sons of the gods came down from heaven, and then the story begins. You know, that's the opening line in the so-called history, you know, the Sumerians or whatever, is you have a coming down from heaven to earth beginning, you know, and then things rationalize forward from there. All right. Anything else there? No, I think we got it. Let's see if we can get a little bit more here.
Since the 100 corporeal members of the prince's staff carry germplasm of the Adonic human strains, it would naturally be expected that if they engaged in sexual reproduction, their progeny would altogether resemble the offspring of other Andonite parents. But when the 60 rebels of the staff, the followers of Nod, actually engaged in sexual reproduction, their children proved to be far superior in almost every way to both the Andonite and the Sangic peoples. This unexpected excellence characterized not only physical and intellectual qualities, but also spiritual capacities.
Okay, so see, just literally, this greater genetics affects the encirclement in the Holy Spirit. Yeah. Right? Also, spiritual capacities, right? The creative Mother Spirit. Giving you first the capacity that you're analogizing as the upper domain in the hourglass analogy, you know, as a volume, right, of that upper domain, right? You know, how much capacity she can give you, and obviously then what fills that capacity is all predicated on the genetics. Think both quantity and quality, see, is affected. Is there kind of, you know, giving it between the lines there? So, you know, that reminds you of what kind of a nature that aristocracy, see, would have had. You know, I think Barbara was kind of saying they would have been these very objective, spiritually conscious individuals that could have been wonderful leaders for everyone. And of course, when all is said and done, that's the whole point. I mean, the whole foundation is so that you can have a greater in quantity and quality spiritualized mind, right? That's your personal mind. Right? That's the point, you know, of all this. Yep. So,
I mean, were the Dalmatians essentially privy to kind of, you know, what the carriers had?
Sure. Planning? Sure. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
So that was all up above board.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they would have known all the plans, and right, it's not like the life carriers were doing this in secret or anything. Yeah, yeah, they would have known. It would have been totally informed on exactly, you know, by the life carriers would have told them directly, you know, exactly what the whole point it was and what the plans were. And
right, because that was a 500,000 year
whatever plan. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. You know, and so the thing that is left dangling is like, well, why were they so different run-of-the-mill Andonite children? Well, that's what they're about to explain here, so let's read a little bit more.
These mutant traits appearing in the first Naudite generation resulted from certain changes which had been wrought in the configuration and in the chemical constituents of the inheritance factors of the endonic germplasm. These changes were caused by the presence in the bodies of the staff members of the powerful life maintenance circuits of the Satania system. These life circuits caused the chromosomes of the specialized Urantia pattern to reorganize more after the patterns of the standardized Satania specialization of the ordained Nebadon life manifestation. The technique of this germplasm metamorphosis by the action of the system life currents is not unlike those procedures whereby Urantia scientists modify the germplasm of plants and animals by the use of X-rays.
Okay, so because in the late 20s, scientists were discovering the mutagenic nature of X-rays. You know, they can throw in that little reference there. See, that's what they're saying. So not only when you're plugged into this, all this mysterious stuff that they keep referring to, that the master physical controllers are feeding into them, I mean, not only is it, you know, working with the fruit of the tree of life and keeping them from aging and, you know, making them immortal and all this, but it's literally, you know, mutagenic. You know, it's altering their DNA over time. They're bathed in a mutagenic bath. And so, you know, in the case of the prince's staff, you know, unlike with Adam and Eve, in the case of the prince's staff, you're starting with Andonite DNA, basically. I'm sure they had to do some tweaking, you know, because they add all this additional stuff and whatnot, but it's basically Andonite DNA. But over time, it starts to get more and more like material son and daughter in this local system, DNA. You know, that's what the standardized Satania specialization or the ordained Nebadon life manifestation, that's the material son and daughter in this local system type DNA. Yeah. Right. So that by, you know, after 300,000 years, they're kind of Adamic rather than endonic. Okay. But not merely Adamic, right? There's this very, you know, different phenomenon genetically. You know, a curious homogeneous blend, if you will, of a pre-colored race, you know, and a material son and daughter genetics.
Yeah. And then whatever
on.
The Avalon surgeons were up to. I mean, how often does that happen?
Yes. As we're just about to mention, we'll get to the Avalon surgeons in just 1 second. We'll just read that one other tiny little paragraph, and then we'll wrap it up here.
Could you tell me what the germplasm X-ray, what does that do to us? Is that a bad thing?
Well, again, I mean, if, you know, they've started doing experiments like with fruit flies, you know, expose fruit flies to intense X-rays, and you can, you know, mutate them, barley to intense. I mean, there's a reason why, you know, you're supposed to limit how much X-ray exposure, because, of course, you know, the other thing is, you know, this might not be an appropriate mutation sort of a thing. It might just be damage.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's a reason why you should limit your X-ray exposure.
We use it for diagnosis.
Right, yeah. Right. We discovered pretty early on, you know, that you can also do a lot of damage. I mean, it's a very high energy, you know, event. Now, so, you know, on the one hand, it can be like a bullet, you know, blowing a hole in your DNA. But on the other hand, if it just happens to be just so, you know, it can rearrange things and you can, you know, have mutations. You know, so a species that's kind of robust can handle a lot of, you know, messing around, right? You know, you will actually, you know, mutate into something that you can then observe, oh, I've got a different kind of a fruit fly now. Or my barley is different than it was before. You know, and it's not dead or whatever. It's actually still living. But you're causing rearrangements of the molecules.
Is that the basic technique they used to make, like, genetically modified foods, GMOs? Is that the basic technique?
Well, no, I mean, you know, there's a lot more sophisticated stuff. You know, that's pretty crude stuff to just, well, let's stick it in an X-ray beam. You know, that's... that's kind of hoping that when a tornado goes to the junkyard, it leaves a washing machine behind, you know? I mean, but nonetheless, you know, they're just saying, you know, you, because we recently discovered that, it's like, you know, okay, you kind of know this mutagenic thing now. So, yeah, it does that, only, you know, in a very proper way, right? It's not damaging their chromosomes. Oh, and by the way, just quickly there, notice if they want to say chromosomes, they say chromosomes.
Yeah.
Right. So when you go back and say, oh, they mean chromosomes when they're talking about trait determiners, no, they don't mean chromosomes. They would have said chromosomes if they meant chromosomes.
What are the life currents that they're talking about?
Again, we don't know. Right, there's not only the we speculated on that. You have sub-electronic, you know, dead energies that they're manipulating, but there's also the living energies that they're manipulating. I mean, so they just mean all of the energies that the physical controllers are managing that have an influence on living things. Right, so remember, they don't explain any of that. We speculated about that a bit back when we were talking about what's going on with the Tree of Life and all that stuff. All right, so, yeah, let's just read this, you know, tiny little paragraph and wrap it up here.
Thus did the Nod-Eyed peoples arise out of a certain peculiar and unexpected modifications occurring in the life plasm, which had been transferred from the bodies of the Andonite contributors to those of the corporeal staff members by the Avalon surgeons.
So basically what you get there is, oh, there's those Avalon surgeons. Yeah, and just quickly, I mean, remember, you know, we talked about that before. See, because you're dealing with all of these physical phenomena and stuff, you know, and very much in the way they synchronize with the local system energies and everything, you don't want our life carriers literally being modified and being hands-on in this. So you have to bring in ones from a different local universe that aren't plugged in and can kind of just work on the parts more without it, you know, being in this holistic mode where they're going to mess it up. You know, you need guys that can just do the part-wise thing and they're not plugged into the system.
Can't hometown this.
Right, so you got to literally go outside of our womb. You've got to get someone that's not plugged into this creative mother spirit. To go hands-on on this. Because it's just, you want someone who can just play with the parts, but not alter how this is affected, plugged into the system. You know, you don't want additional life animation coming into play or anything like that. I mean, so our local universe, not just our life carriers, but any life carriers in our local universe can't do the job because they're all plugged into our creative mother spirit.
It's a different local universe. These guys have a different local
haul universe. Them all the way from a nobody different local universe.
Pretty cool.
So we don't know all the details, but we at least know that much, right? I mean, basically why you have to bring them in. You need them to be just like our surgeons, that are just playing with your parts and not altering your relationship at all, because they can't, right?
The father of the kid who needs surgery is probably not doing the surgery.
Right? Yeah, so anyway, that's the kind of the deal with having that additional paragraph, is to remind you of again, just how complex this is, what we're talking about, how much physics is involved. All right, so anyway, we'll stop there and finish up the rest of this section next time. And you can see, if you flip forward, we got a whole bunch of stuff. We get talking about the Bible. We got the Tower of Babel and all kinds of stuff here, or Tower of Babel. All right, so let's just take a moment here, everyone.